Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Fiat.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 314 for December 18th of 2015. Presents, Cole and Chorus. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 20 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Bravo, bravo, bravo. What a unique open to the show. This is the Motor City Choral. We're going to get into explaining why they're here. It's got a little bit to do with more than just Christmas, although that's the obvious tie-in so far. But we'll get to that later in the show. First, I got to welcome my co-host here, Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine. Great to have you here.
Boy, this is fantastic, huh?
This is great. And there's more to the story, as you well know.
We'll get to that later.
But we also have to let everybody know that we're also joined by Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press and Scott Burgess from Yahoo Autos. Great to have the both of you guys here, too.
Great to be here. Mark and I will be doing a duet as well later.
They'll be after on the duet day, you know,
the parking lot after the show.
Yeah, and, right. But, of course, we've got all of us here to have our traditional Presents and Cole presentation for the best and the worst of what happened in the automotive industry in 2015. And we'll be interspersing that with some Christmas music here just to keep the cheer going as we lead into the holiday season. So let's start it out. And, Gary, you want to kick it off?
All right. So I'm all presents this year because, you know, it's all about giving. It's all about joy.
I know you that. Jolly old elf.
I am, and I know that.
Additional sponsors for the program.
Possibly. So I would
drum
give...
Drum roll, please.
Okay. We're not going to hear that drum roll. Okay. I give a present to Larry Page and Sergey Brin for hiring John Krafcik at Google.
A present? Hmm.
Just for setting him free from TrueCar?
I thought he already left TrueCar, didn't he?
I know, but yeah. I mean...
Didn't
he deserve better?
Okay, so here's the situation where Google is talking about doing an autonomous car. So who better than somebody from the auto industry who has extensive product development knowledge, who ran Hyundai, and who had that dealership experience to a degree with TrueCar. So I think that's a fantastic thing.
I think he's a great fit. You know, his presence may be present enough for them. But also, you know, I think that we're not going to see anything from him for another year or two. I wonder what he's going to be doing over this time. Is it just setting up plans and moving things forward? And, it's one where... I think eventually he'll be a good fit. I don't know if he's a good fit right now.
No, I think, look, Krafcik's one of the best in the business, no question about it. He's got a breadth of experience. I think it is a coup for Google to get him. Word just came out today or late yesterday that they're going to spin Google's autonomous car effort off as an Alphabet company, which is Google's new name, as you guys know. But I'll reserve judgment until we see what actually happens. I agree. For Google, it's a great get. Now Krafchuk's got to prove himself in doing whatever the hell it is that Google's going to do.
There was also a report that they were going to be coming out with an autonomous car next year.
Well, and isn't that the question? I mean, and I agree with you. He's a great ad, and they've been hiring other good people as well. They're building automotive expertise to go along with everything else that they're going to do. But we still don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Do we? Are they making a car? Do they want to be a supplier to everybody else? I mean, what exactly is Google Car?
They're going to be the Uber of autonomous cars, is my prediction. They're going to provide mobility services. They'll make cars, but not to put in showrooms. To have their own, this is my prediction, their own driverless taxi system, as it were.
Or to Mark's point, though, they could basically do what they did with their Android system for phones, right? They just license it to people.
Yeah,
so
I've always...
They could license their automotive technology to people.
And that's what I've always thought was the play. Be a supplier to everybody instead of a competitor with everybody. But we don't know.
Well, and the other question is, if they're going to make the Google cars, are they going to look as stupid as the Google cars that they have right now?
With a little beanie propeller on top?
Because, you know,
we need the beanie propeller.
I doubt that those things have any passage of any safety regulations.
Correct.
I think that, you know.
I think other cars just bounce off.
They might. Yeah, it looks like they'll just pop. And you know, I mean, I know that they're going for efficiency and a certain look and everything, but, man, they're ugly.
Although I was talking to John at the LA show, and
John Krafchuk,
and so he said to me, he said, "Did you see the picture of the cop that pulled the Google car over?" He said, "Didn't that look mean? Don't you look at that car and just sort of want to hug it?"
Yeah, maybe. Okay, Scotty, let's hear your first one.
Well, you know, I mean, I was rumored that I was only going to give out coal, but I do have a couple of presents that I'll give out. So the first one I'll do is nice, which is I think that Al Oppenheiser, the chief engineer for the Chevy Camaro, deserves a big, giant present because
you like that car.
That car is just phenomenal. It's, you know, the ATS platform is a really great platform. All of the things that the Camaro needed to improve on, it did. And driving that car is a lot of fun. And you didn't think it could be that much more. And GM's real push for getting weight out of cars.
They're doing some of the best effort in the business.
Yeah.
Without going to, you know, exotic materials. They're just doing it through excellent
design. It's that modular approach that they talk about a lot, which is any place that they can do a weight reduction, they do it. And that really harkens back to Oppenheiser, who, when they were making the Z28, talked about that. Will shorten the lengths of bolts. If the bolt, that bolt piece that sticks out the end of the bolt, the nut, if it doesn't need to be there, we'll cut it off. If we can make the window a millimeter thinner, and all of a sudden it adds up to real weight savings. And I mean, that's a key for going forward for everything. And you see that in the Malibu that's just coming out. And every car that comes out, it's going to have to go on a diet. And
so we talked about this on one show, that the question between Camaro versus Mustang. Where do you come down on that with the new product?
I'd rather sit inside a Mustang and I'd rather drive a Camaro.
Okay, who's going to win the sales war? Mustang's winning it right now. Give the new Camaro a full year head-to-head with the Mustang.
Camaro beat it.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
What do you think about that Camaro?
It's a marvelous car. I'm withholding final judgment till I've, you know, driven the convertible. Because that's the one that's going to be fun. Because even as good as the current one is, they've still got the teeny tiny little windows that are like looking out through a gun slit.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember
Monitor or Merrimack. Which one of those?
Yes. But no, it really is.
It's the Virginia.
It's a fairly wonderful car, and the 2-liter turbo engine is going to be extremely interesting too. To see, you know, how good is it? What kind of fuel economy?
Yeah. Who would have thought a 4-cylinder engine we'd be raving about in a Camaro?
Yep. Yep. So I will, just to make things interesting, I will say that the Camaro will win in the first full year that they've got both models anyway. You know, the first year there's a full year of convertible sales as well.
Okay, Mark, keep going. Your turn for a present or a lump of coal.
Everybody else being nice, so I'm going to dish out a piece of coal. Good. And the biggest, most obvious piece of coal, so you're all going to have a second choice now. My piece of coal is to Volkswagen, its diesel engines, its engineers, and most of all, its management. The management that allowed the culture where the fraudulent diesel engines were designed to be, you know, built, brought to production, sold, the management that, you know, said, yes, we're going to claim these are the cleanest engines in the world because we are going to turn a blind eye to the fact that so many people within our organization don't know that they are not. And also the management that still 4 months later is saying, yeah, we've got an internal investigation. We'll figure out who's really responsible.
It's only a small rogue group.
Just a small rogue group. Just one guy with a slide rule. It's ridiculous. And they are making themselves look worse and worse, I think, with every minute that goes past.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And we probably all chose Volkswagen for a lump of coal.
I had Parkula emitting coal.
See, but since I was only giving out presents, I was giving a present to Daniel Carter for heading up the West Virginia University team that discovered the Volkswagen diesel problem.
Well, wait a minute here, because I gave a present to the International Council on Clean Transportation.
Who hired these guys,
I think, knowing full well what they were going to find. So I don't think the University of West Virginia discovered anything. They didn't go out and start the investigation.
But they did all the scout work.
Somebody had to come and say, hey, here's the check. Here's what I want you to test. Give me the results. Yeah. So to me, the ICCT are the ones who sniffed this out, in my opinion, and that's why I give them a present. But I thought you were going to give a lump of coal to Tesla, since outside of California, that's what most of their cars run on.
You know, the other question, last thing on the coal side, is I wonder, do you think any car makers knew that Volkswagen was cheating because there was no way that they could figure out a way to get the same mileage Volkswagen got?
This is my own personal opinion. I believe some car company whispered in the ear of the ICCT saying, whisper, 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 you ought to go out and do these kinds of tests and see what you come up with.
Okay, why did it take so long, though?
Why did it take so long to what?
To do the whispering in the ear since the
well, they were running the test
device
for a while.
What, 2009 model year?
Yeah, well, yeah. Volkswagen admitted they started cheating in 2005. Oh. They started holding the meetings to plan all this stuff to be able to cheat on it.
Okay, but the first engines were out in vehicles.
2008?
Right.
Calendar 2008, model year 2009. Yeah. So let's say you're sitting in Stuttgart and you're saying, wow, how are those guys doing it? Because we can only do it with SCR.
Everybody said that. A lot of people said, Volkswagen can do it.
But if you talk to the real diesel people, they were saying that for 2 liters displacement and below, they thought there was an opportunity in a light car to be able to meet.
But how much of the reason they thought was the opportunity was there was because Volkswagen was saying we've done it.
No. These were other people in the industry who were not doing anything with Volkswagen. And it wasn't until, I want to say, gosh, and I wish my brain was better on this. It wasn't until about 2010 where everybody said, no, you got to have urea injection. And then they started going, wait a minute, how's Volkswagen getting by without this? So I think it took a while for people to go, wait a minute, how are they doing this? And then it was like maybe they did some of their own testing, and then very surreptitiously they had to whisper in the ear of the ICCT. ICCT denies this completely. They said nobody tipped us off.
And they did some of their own testing in Europe first, trying to figure out what was going on, and they still couldn't match the numbers Volkswagen was claiming. And that was when they decided, okay, let's try somebody in America, see if there's something different going on.
Well, what they wanted to do.
I mean, it took a while. I think it's not unreasonable that it took a while to figure it out.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that.
Because the system is based on plain fare. If you're setting up something to cheat, I mean, you're cheating. And it's harder to detect.
That's right.
If you're a good cheater.
If you're a good cheater. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so.
In engineering.
All right.
We got two presents and two lumps of coal.
You
got
to give something out besides this ICCT thing.
Okay, so I gave out a present to the ICCT. Time to go to a lump of coal. And my first lump of coal goes to the guys that did the Jeep hack herd round the world. And remember that.
Miller and Vlasic.
Oh, is that who it was? Okay, and they had prearranged this with Wired magazine. They stuck one of the Wired reporters in this Jeep. They took control of the vehicle remotely, miles away, you know, had to do all these goofy things. I commend them in one way for getting the headlines all around the world. I disparage them or give them a lump of coal because of the way they went about doing this. And that was, I've called them glory hounds. They wanted to go into DEF CON, you know, the black hat hackers convention as heroes, which they did. They got hired by, who was it? Was it Uber hired them, I think it was?
Yeah.
And so, to me, I like that they did this, but other researchers have done just as impressive a hacks several years before, but kept it all on the QT, notified the companies that they were able to hack into, hey, we did this, you should be able to have a fix for all this stuff. These guys completely opposite. They went in there wanting headlines around the world for themselves, and they got it. And because of their approach, I give them a lump of coal.
But didn't most of the other companies who hacked it and then said it quietly do it for the payoff as well? They then got hired as consultants by the companies they
hacked
too. Or others.
That happens,
yeah.
Too.
So, I mean, it wasn't pure altruism in those cases.
Well, I know, but look, everybody's out. You know, everybody's got to have a job, right? They got to come up with something to do. But, you know, these guys took it way over
the
top.
Okay, but those guys had actually done work at the DEF CON conference previously,
yeah.
Okay? And I think the University of Washington's been doing a lot of research in this whole area.
Correct.
As well. And the thing of it is that, okay, so they've been, they've been saying, look, here are these big flaws, here are these big holes, and nobody's done anything about it. But as soon as they did this major thing where, I mean, when you read the story in Wired, I mean, the guy's like, you know, they weren't supposed to do this to me. I'm going to die inside this car. And that raised the attention among the public of, you know, these possible cybersecurity flaws within vehicles, because all we've heard is how wonderful it is that we all have these capabilities and these wireless hotspots and they can do this, that, and the other thing. And I got to commend them for saying, hey, this is a serious problem that needs to be addressed sooner rather than later before something really goes bad.
And the car companies can't claim that they were unaware it could be done, because they had seen it done, you know, before. So I'm with you. I give them. I've got some questions about their methodology, but on the whole, I'd give them a present as well.
Well, you know, you're right in that regard, because Chrysler FCA sat on its hands for 18 months. They knew the Uconnect system could be hacked. They didn't do anything about it. The one good thing that these two hackers, what were their names again?
Miller and Vlasic
did is Chrysler was then forced by NHTSA to recall those cars. It cost them over $100 million, $105, $110 million, something like that. So instantly, everybody in the industry knew, oh, that's what our budget is for preventing this. You know, we can spend X tens of millions of dollars to prevent hacking, because if we don't, we know it's going to cost us at least $100 million. So it's kind of ironic that it took a hack for the finance people to put a line item on the budget for anti-hacking activities.
Well, it took a P.T. Barnum hack to do it. I mean, because it was just like, okay, you know, otherwise they're just going to say, yeah, that's fine. Let's, did you see this feature that we have in this car? You know,
but to me, that was one of the more significant news developments of 2015, was the hack heard round the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Gary, we got a little bit of time before the break. Let's go to one more.
All right. So this is sort of in keeping with what Scott was saying. I would give Mark Royce, who's in charge of product development at General Motors, I'd give him a present for keeping product development at General Motors on an upward trajectory. I mean, we had the Colorado and Canyon Diesel. We had the ATS-V, the Camaro, the new Malibu, the new Volt. I mean, these guys are really...
That's just this year. Silverado.
Right. I mean, and he's doing a hell of a job. I think he needs...
They don't have a dog in the group.
He needs to get a lot of credit for what he's done.
I'd agree with
Silverado's going to be the big thing next year, right? I mean...
Silverado.
That's the next one's a year or so farther out, I think. But everything they've done over the last couple of years in the previous Silverado... that was introduced. I mean, it's been hit after hit. I think you're going to have a hard time finding anybody to disagree with you, about Mark Royce deserving presents.
Yeah, no kidding.
You can disagree. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
No, I like Mark, and I think Mark's done a great job.
Hate that Corvette Z06, right?
I think that GM is better served by Mark in the role that he has today than if he would have been the CEO.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think he knows that, too.
Why?
The consummate product guy.
He's the product guy, and he's right where he should be. And you look at all of the stuff that's coming out, and he has a direct influence on that. I don't think that he could have as much of an influence if he was CEO. He'd be doing, spending time with shareholders and doing all of this other stuff that is not the car guy's dream job.
Well, and he and Mary Barra are really a terrific team
in
the two jobs they're in. And they've worked together so much throughout their whole careers. I mean, they've had desks that were together going back 20 years, you know, on different projects. So, I mean, it's a really good group, a pair at the top of GM right now.
No, I'd agree with that. I think, you know, GM, top to bottom, is turning out the best product in its in my career. Top to bottom. There's been other great products in the past, but there were a few dogs in there, too. Not anymore. I'm super impressed by what they got. Okay. We're going to take a quick commercial break here. We're going to have the choir lead us into that break. And then coming out of that, Dr. Data's got a few things that he's got to lay down on us number-wise. Then we're going to learn more about what this choir is all about and why they're here with us today. But first, shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Right, bravo.
This is,
they're pros. This is, we're going to have to do this more often. I mean, Christmas once a year, this is not enough. I really like this. But now, it's time for Dr. Data and a number.
Okay, so Carmen, could you bring the number up, please?
7.
Well, it'll be here. I can't see it, so. Carmen? There we go.
261.
All right. So, you know, when Scott was going to be on the show and he was going to talk about all that coal, I began to worry about the amount of coal that existed in the United States. So I looked to see. So according to the Energy Information Administration, which is the official U.S. government source of all things about fuels, that they say that the amount of coal that exists in the ground will be good for 261 years, that would bring us to the year of 2276. So you would have the ability to dump on everyone for all that period of time. Now, this is predicated on the 2013 coal production, which is 256.7 billion short tons of coal that's taken out on an annual basis. So
it's a lot of coal.
That's how much is there. I said it backwards.
So. Okay. These are global numbers?
No, this is the United States has the...
Alone.
256.7 billion short tons of recoverable coal. So that'll take us to 2276 of these shows.
Oh.
Okay. So the thing that happens, though, in 2276, that suddenly the coal will be the present, right? Because it'll be so rare.
Yeah.
It'll be like diamonds.
Yeah.
So you'll want to just give people something else. I don't know what that'll be. So that's our number. 261 years of coal is left.
Good.
Well, I feel so much more knowledgeable now.
So I want some coal from you.
I would give this one a whole year's worth of coal.
Okay, let's hear it, Scott.
Tesla VP Dermot O'Connell. He spoke recently at the Detroit Athletic Club, and they come in, and Tesla, you know, I like their vehicles. Everybody likes their vehicles. But he comes in and gives a speech about how Tesla would be doing better if everyone else built better electric cars. And it's really Detroit's fault that Tesla is not doing better.
So he says.
So he says. I'm sure their stock went up immediately after this speech came out, which is always kind of one of the things that happens with Tesla. But I just found the whole idea. Look, I understand that if you work in Silicon Valley, that you can be an arrogant ass. And they have a lot of reasons to be arrogant. But I also just found the speech one of those things where you're like, I really don't need to be sitting here listening to this. I don't think it serves anybody any good. And I think it's just insulting when you've just launched your Model X 2 years late and three times the price it was supposed to be, telling everyone else how they should be doing better with their electric vehicles when they're actually trying to produce electric vehicles that regular people can buy instead of the 1% vehicles that they make.
Look, not only that, they can't make any money. Tesla can't, selling $100,000 cars.
Well,
so,
you hear the BS about
there's a problem
with
that.
You know, the lobbying and the big auto, but then they go behind everybody's back and get CARB to change all their rules so that they can get more ZEV credits, which is the only way they've made any money so far.
So do you think that when the Chevy Bolt comes out, that he'll be able to say, see?
I think Elon Musk will piss all over the Chevy Volt, no matter what. If it had a range of 5,000 miles on 10 cents of electricity, that there's no way he's going to be saying that.
Well, I mean, Tesla's entire communications strategy is built around not paying too much attention to their bottom line, but making fun of the established automakers and saying they're much better at this than the established automakers are. I mean, It really is sort of a shell game. And each of the vehicles they've built so far have been lovely to look at and wonderful to drive, but they haven't made any money. They're reliant on being able to trade environmental credits, to people. And, let's see what happens when they try to build more cars that are affordable as well. It's real hard to see what's the exit strategy, for
Well, their exit strategy is 60,000 miles because a report just came out that that's how long the batteries last in a Model S. Is 60,000 miles. That if you chart it, it goes, and at 60,000 miles, the batteries die.
Well, that's the end of the company, if that's true.
Oh, no, it isn't, because he's got the Gigafactory. He'll just make more.
Yeah, but, that means he's going to be handing out free $50,000 batteries, packs.
See, but he'll just drive the price down to see with the volume.
Is that, that's right?
Yeah, 60,000? Yeah, I'm not joking.
Who said that?
I forget where it was, like Reuters.
But that's based on a forecast rather than actual battery failures.
No, because cars are starting to reach the 60,000 mile point.
And failing.
Okay.
Yowza.
Okay.
Yowza. Yeah.
Which is not quite the lifetime guarantee. Well, it is. The lifetime ends at 60,000 miles. But
still find it astonishing, though, that here's this company that has completely changed the focus of the auto industry. I mean, do you think we would have a Porsche Model E were it not for Tesla?
No, and I agree. I think that the disruption that they did was fantastic, that they said, look, we don't need to wait for future technology. We have the technology here today to do electric cars, and they did it. And they did an exceptionally nice. The Roadster was a great car. The Model S is a great car. Model X is way overpriced. But I think that you could do it in such a way. I mean, we were joking inside. I was like, well, if they could figure out a way to run a Model S off of hubris, that those cars would just be perpetual motion machines. And it's one where the dichotomy for me is always, I really like the cars. I just really can't stand the upper management at Tesla, the way that they have this arrogance about them that it goes against my Midwestern
sensibility. No, I'm with you totally on that. I want to see them succeed.
Yeah.
But they don't need to go lecture others until they start making money and prove that they're a real car company. Not just somebody who can build nice cars. Plenty of companies have built nice cars and gone out of business.
Right.
They got to prove that they can stay in business.
All right, so let's talk about why we have this wonderful choir here today. I mean, so there's, you know, here it is, an automotive show, and we've got this choir singing in these wonderful blue shirts. And the genesis of this thing, producer Chip Drake was looking for CDs, and he came upon this CD, which is the General Motors Employees Chorus 1933 to 2003. So he began looking to find this organization, and eventually he found something. And we have Sue Frost, who is the president of the Motor City Chorale. And Sue, so tell us about where you guys came from. What was the beginning, and how did we get to the studio today?
First off, thank you for having us today. The chorus was started in 1933 as an employee activity of General Motors Corporation. And industrial choruses were real popular back then. Ford Motor, Chrysler, Great Lakes Steel, Masco, Chevrolet had their own chorus. And just as the auto company sponsored bowling leagues and baseball teams, they sponsored a chorus. And so General Motors sponsored us until 1977. And during the automotive recession of 1977, they said, we've got to stop all this extracurricular activities. And so we continued on as a community chorus at that point. For years, we sang in the GM building on the last day of the year before the Christmas season ended. We also, in the early 40s, took a train trip to New York and sang in the GM building in New York. So we have represented GM for years and years throughout Metro Detroit. There was an industrial concert every year called Industry Sings, and it would be all the industrial choruses across Metro Detroit. And so you can see there's a picture on the screen of the Industry Sings concert.
So is this like a sing-off? I mean, so it's like you guys and Ford and you know, it's
no,
like
no, although I have to say internally it was a little bit between Ford and GM. But no, it was just to showcase each
Chrysler
industrial
is always in third
chord.
Place.
And at the end, the entire group of 400 or 500 singers would get together and do some mass numbers together. And as the years passed and the choruses got older, that was not the most popular kind of singing. And we changed our name just 2 years ago to the Motor City Chorale to still reflect our heritage of the automotive industries, but to bring it up to date to a more community chorus. We give concerts across Metro Detroit, and we're different from other groups that we don't sell tickets and have one big venue. We go to venues across Metro Detroit. We've given some concerts. I think this is the, and this is Detroit Edison and us at the ballpark during the national anthem.
Detroit Edison has a?
Yes, they have a chorus also. And we have done a concert for the Relief for Haiti Hurricane Fund, Habitat for Humanity. And as a group, we've donated to Turning Point in Macomb. So we give back to the community, and we love when the community gives to us.
So you guys here are just a portion of the group.
The chorus this year is 54 members.
Wow.
And this is just a small group of the chorus. We didn't feel 54 members would comfortably fit in there.
Yeah, couldn't fit in the studio, right?
Yeah, in the studio. And we accept new members in January. You can go to our website. And we still have 3 concerts this weekend to give. And, again, they're on our website. And I think you put the website up there for us. So I'll take questions.
Yeah, I've got a question.
Sure, John.
How many of you used to work at GM or still work at GM? And the others, what?
Well, some
these are enemies from Ford and Chrysler, too.
Hence why we became a community chorus. For a long time, you had to be an employee, and then we opened it up. Probably about a third of the chorus is either a retired spouse or a retired GM employee.
How do you choose what music you're going to sing?
Well,
I mean, it's obvious now. It's Christmas time.
Yeah,
that makes it easy. But when
in the spring, we do some sacred numbers, and then we do some show tunes, which everybody like. And then we usually close our spring season with a salute to our veterans and some patriotic songs in the spring. So that's kind of been the genres that we've stuck with.
You don't do Inagata DeVita, do you?
No.
Just asking.
Although it's been brought up.
Are you serious, really? Oh, my God.
1 year we did give a Christmas concert at the Jewish Community Center, and they loved it. Mm-hmm. And so
everybody,
as long as they were happy, we were happy. That's right. Any other questions for us?
Well, let's see. Did we get any from the audience here? It's possible. Even though we told them we were really not going to take questions. No, somebody's sending in a lump of coal.
All right, so
not for you guys.
So Mark wrote a great story about you guys.
Yeah.
It's in the Sunday Free Press, Detroit Free Press, and so they could probably find it if they Google.
At freep.com if you want to look. It should be easy to find, yeah.
It's mm-hmm. a great picture of us singing in front of a Ford Motor Company site.
I thought it was very funny that they picked that. It was a photo, I think, from the Greenfield Village
yes,
display.
Yes, holiday nights, and we will be there again this year on the 27th of December. We've done it for about 5 years now on holiday nights, and they think it's funny to put us in front of the Ford Motor Company.
So that's a chance for people to see you even after Christmas
yes.
This holiday season.
Yes.
And how do you determine, such as with the music selection for today's show, you get in the ring and punch it out, or how do you determine which songs to sing?
We just picked four songs that we thought were happy and uplifting and that the audience would like.
Well, you nailed that so far. And obviously you practice. How often do you get together? Because seriously, you guys are really good.
We practice every Monday night, January through March. We perform again in April across Metro Detroit, and then we practice September through November Monday nights and sing about, I think we have 15 concerts this December we're singing.
Wow.
Yeah, between seniors, citizens, centers, churches, we did the veterans last night, holiday nights.
So the other companies that had choruses before, I mean, did they exist? I mean,
Edison still exists and Ford Motor Company still exists, but in a much smaller scale than 10 years ago because of singers getting older and venues available and stuff. The Gentleman Songsters is now the old General Motors Chevrolet Choir, Men's Glee Club, and it's called the Gentleman Songsters, and they do mostly barbershop harmony type songs.
And I imagine there's still plenty of choir competitions or more of the bigger industry sing kind of events.
We don't do the industry sings anymore, but it's ironic that on our days off in December, we're all going to concerts. And so we go around and listen to the other groups. So there is still a little bit of competition in there.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, look, we're coming up to our next break. We've got to give a shout-out to our friends at Fiat for sponsoring the show, but I think you all ought to lead us into that break and then back out of it again.
The all-new Fiat 500 X crossover, featuring an available Uconnect system with a 6.5-inch touchscreen and available all-wheel drive. Well-rounded, has never looked so sharp.
All right. I love this. I think it's fantastic. We got to do more shows like this. Okay, back to the serious business at hand. We've got to give out some more lumps of coal and presents. Mark Phelan, you're up.
I will go with a present this time, and I'm going to put together three, you know, presents that I had on my initial list. I'm going to call this Welcome to the Prodigal Sons. We have three brands, three cars, three vehicles that made a huge comeback, you know, this year. Three of the best new vehicles that were introduced in the year. The Volvo XC90, a wonderful SUV, first thing Volvo has developed since Ford sold them to a Chinese company, engineered and built in Sweden, they'll hasten to tell you, but breakthrough truck, really good truck. And two of the three finalists for North American Car of the Year, the Chevy Malibu and the Honda Civic, both of these had been good cars over the years. There had been a couple of great Malibus. Civic had been great forever. And both of them really fell off the rails in the last generation. They lost any shot at leadership. They came back with a vengeance this year. I think that they are each, you know, the Malibu's clearly a leader among midsize sedans again. Civic is a leader among compacts. Just a really good return to form by those three companies and cars.
Yeah, no, I'd echo that. Totally, especially the Volvo story. Great vehicle, but the behind-the-scenes story of them coming back is equally impressive.
And so much new technology in a vehicle. I mean, a new architecture, really impressive new engine, new infotainment system, completely different than anything else. And this was all the first effort out of the box by a company that had been reconstituted after being owned by Ford for, what, 15 years. I mean,
you know,
it's really...
It's very interesting that they, you know, you mentioned the new powertrain. I mean, a very gutsy move, four-cylinder strategy. Turbocharged, supercharged engines, but I mean, that's it.
Big as well SUV,
as,
too.
As well as a hybrid version, but again, using the same engine. And to think that, you know, here you'd have this three-row SUV being powered by a four-cylinder engine. I mean, it's remarkable. And, you know,
2 liters, 300 horsepower.
It may be the first time a big SUV like that could have its engine sit in the third row. I mean, that's how small that engine is compared to what everything else goes in those things.
And it's a comfortable third row, too.
Yeah, it's XC90 is just a wonderful SUV. Mm-hmm. And
well, now we got to see how it sells, right? Because we've seen multiple luxury or near-luxury brands try to make a comeback. Cadillac, Lincoln, Acura, Infiniti. Now Hyundai jumping in with the Genesis mm-hmm. brand. Holy moly. You know, the other ones that I mentioned... they haven't pulled it off yet. They're turning out a great product, but the sales haven't kept pace with how good the product is. So now we got to see, can Volvo really get its sales going again?
Well, as you know, I mean, they're starting from here. So if they get to here, that'll be...
Percentage-wise,
they'll double.
It'll be fantastic. And in a couple of weeks on the show, we'll have the interior designer of that vehicle.
Trisha Johnson. Great interior. That's going to be a good show.
Yeah. Right. And, yeah. So Malibu and Civic, where are you on those two?
excuse me. Malibu, I think, is really nice. I don't think it's as nice as the Civic. I don't think it's as impactful of changing the segment. I think that the Civic really, it raises the bar for everyone in that segment. I think the Malibu raises the bar a little bit. I think that the Malibu finally competes. You know, it's tough to sell against a Camry and an Accord because people that buy those cars just go, I got to get a car. And it's synonymous for Camry or Accord.
I like Robert Davis's comment. Remember, we had him here last week from Mazda. And just to explain how competitive the CD segment is, he calls it the Fallujah of the auto industry.
Absolutely. And then, you know, I don't know if the Malibu will have that big of an impact. You know, they sell 200,000 a year. Will it go to 250, which would be great. But, you know, Toyota is going to sell 420,000 Camrys this year.
Right.
But, you know, even Toyota says it expects the RAV4 to emerge as its best-selling car.
Right.
As people leave the passenger car segment and go into crossovers, I think the same thing could happen with the Civic. And I'm with you. I think the Civic is a more impactful car than the Malibu, even though I think the Malibu is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But you're right. It gets Civic back to where it was, and it's so quiet. It changes the bar for all compact cars right now. But having said that, as the market migrates to crossovers, Civic may not do as well, even though the car itself is better.
I think, well, and the years of 400,000, maybe even 300,000 unit cars are probably gone or going away forever because the market is fragmented so much. I mean, there's so many types of vehicles that didn't exist before,
yeah,
but it's going to be very hard for anybody to get to those kind of numbers. But still, to be a leader in either of those segments is a big deal.
I think that if, yeah, you judge by just nameplates alone, that if at the very worst, every car maker only sold one of their nameplates in the crossover section, it would still be 40% of the entire market. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are just so many different crossovers from, look at Honda, the addition of the HRV. Does that take Civic sales away?
No, it killed the Fit sales.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, killed them. Yep. The Fit's
and
dead.
The Fit was not a bad car, but the HRV is a much better vehicle.
It's a good thing it's a Fit platform, so they...
Yeah. Exactly. and that's why the car companies don't care. They're just as happy and happier probably to sell an HRV because you can charge a higher price
for it. Exactly. Better margins. Okay, Gary, you're up.
All right, I want to give...
Give Coal.
I can't.
Just change one of them to Coal.
I sort of could.
No, go ahead. Give a present.
All right. So I'll give a present to Mark Fields and Raj Nair for the Ford GT.
Okay.
Those guys backed what is arguably folly, right? I mean, do we really need this car? No. But, boy, I'm glad this car exists.
No, I think you do need a car like that. I think a car company needs a halo vehicle, or a brand certainly needs a halo
vehicle. But this is sort of like... In another realm.
Right. But they're going to do stuff with it, too. It's not just that it's out there. They're going to race it in Le Mans,
Right.
It's going to
the 50th anniversary of Ford winning Le Mans.
Right.
And Ford is really good at milking events for that for every drop.
We'll be hearing about it for the next 6 years.
Yeah. But it's more than a marketing effort.
What if they lose?
As long as it blows up good.
But
in front of everybody.
Give them credit. I'm a bit closer to the did they need that car camp. But you have to give them credit for pushing all the chips out in the middle of the table and say, we're going to build this incredibly gorgeous, incredibly advanced car. And yes, we are going to risk looking like fools when we race it against everybody else in the world at Le Mans.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you got to salute that.
It's gutsy.
Yeah.
The other thing that I like about the car is it really is a rolling R&D testbed. They're trying out all different kinds of things in materials, in turbocharging, in aerodynamics, in. They're Gorilla Glass, even for the windshield. I mean, they're throwing everything in the kitchen sink at this thing. And I love that approach. I don't want to just see, scientists in lab coats with beakers. I want the stuff out on the track, proving the new technology to make the production cars better. And that's the approach I like seeing a car company take.
Well, and just like Ford as a mass volume brand, you can argue they don't need this incredibly advanced, beautiful $400,000 car. But they've done stuff like that in the past, so it is part of their heritage. I mean, there was a GT before, so it does make some sense. Just like, an accountant could probably look at Chevrolet and say, the Corvette's got no business being in this brand, but it's there and it adds to the brand. So, I'm glad the GT exists.
Right. And I think it's a very gutsy move, though. Because you said, pushing the chips out on the table. It's a lot of money that they're putting on this thing, right?
Le Mans is a really great place for newcomers to get embarrassed, So
but remember, they're not going for the overall win. And the two brands that dominate that right now, Audi and Porsche, Audi's been dominating, Porsche just to upset them this year. But they're spending Formula One kind of money. If you're going to go and do the full season plus Le Mans, you're looking at a bill of at least $400 million. That's a lot of money to spend on a racing effort. Ford, my guess, is spending about half that because they're not going for the overall win.
But if they show up and blow up, the people who think, look, they failed, aren't going to compare the balance sheets.
I think this car out of the box is going to do better than most people expect for a green effort because, they've been racing in a DP class. They won the 24 hours of Daytona. They came that close to winning the 12 hours of Sebring. The engine that they're using is completely proven. Absolutely proven. They've got the durability in it. That's dropping right into the GT. So now it's a matter of sorting out the rest of the car. They'll run a team, two teams here in the U.S., two cars in the U.S., two cars in Europe. By the time June rolls around, Le Mans, they're going to have quite a few race miles under their belt. I think this car is going to do better than most green efforts. That is, you know, somebody just coming right back into the sport. They've laid the groundwork to do this. And my prediction, too, is if they roll up, I don't expect them to win out, but if they do very well in 2016, 17, 18, I think they'll have the guts to say, let's go for the overall win. Let's go take on Audi and Porsche. Gary doesn't buy it.
I want some coal.
Yeah, let's hear it. You guys lay it on us here, Scott.
You guys are all sissies. Oh, I got the one that'll get Mark all wound up. I want to give coal to David Zukowski, the president of Hyundai, for not announcing this year that the Santa Cruz is going to be a production vehicle.
So explain what the Santa Cruz is.
The Santa Cruz is basically the Hyundai El Camino. Very, very small car-based
Ranchero.
Car-based pickup truck that nobody else here thinks that they should make.
Yeah, it's the El Camino or the Ranchero or the Subaru Brat or the Volkswagen Caddy pickup, what do they call it?
Wow, very good.
It is the latest in a long line of small pickups destined to fail. That's why you're right. Oh, you could not have gotten me more wound up. And why? Why do people keep building, you know, these vehicles? It's small. It looks great. On an auto show stand, it looks great. Just about everybody who goes to an auto show says, wow, I'd really like to have that. And then they think about, would I like to pay for it? What could I do with it that I couldn't do better with a real truck or a real crossover SUV? And nobody buys it. So and Hyundai seems very serious about building it.
They do. I don't think what they're going to ultimately build will be anything like that. I think that it'll be a more of a just a pickup that's car-based.
And even that is a great way to lose money, I think. I mean, Honda, strong company, great engineering, the Ridgeline.
It was ugly. Holy.
It was huge. They did a crew cab, and then
it cost a lot, and it couldn't tow much.
It was
but that kind of gets back to so why don't you just buy an F-150?
So why is Honda going to do another Ridgeline?
That's a really good question.
They're selling up to 800 a month, and so, I mean, I could see...
Listen, look.
Yeah, 10,000 trucks a year. Give me some of that action.
Look, everybody's looking at the pickup segment going, how do we get in on this? There's so much money to be made. And everyone's trying to hit all these little niches because they know it's suicide to go up against the Silverado F-150 and Ram. So they're trying to hit, you know, around the edges here. But what the mistake that they make is not talking to real truckers. And I'm not saying that I'm a real trucker, but I'm a mountain biker, I'm a cross-country and downhill skier. And when you come out with a inky-dinky little bed where I can't get my bike or my skis in there, forget about it. And everybody wants a smaller bed because they don't want to look like a big pickup. That's the reason why the Colorado and the Canyon don't look that small, because they put a bed on them that you can actually use. So I think if Hyundai puts a usable bed on that Santa Fe, it may ruin the styling proportions, but it's going to make people say, you know, that's the kind of...
Yeah, I think that it's got to be a toy hauler. Mm-hmm. That's what that
got to put bikes and runners and ATVs. They got to be able to fit in the back.
Track. Yeah, but a little bit bigger bed. You know, you need a 6-foot bed instead of a 5-foot 5 bed.
Mm-hmm.
And even on the Colorado with the small bed, I tell people, get the long bed. If you're going to buy it with the 6-foot bed. Because it just, there's a lot more room. It doesn't sound like it's a lot. 7 inches is a big difference. And it's the difference between putting your bike in there and closing the tailgate and not closing the tailgate.
Yeah.
And those things do need to be measured. But I've always been a big advocate of a car-based pickup. And I think the problem is with pickups is that too many truck guys get in there and mess it up, and they make it more, it's got to be able to tow 8,000. No, it doesn't. 2,000 pounds. You need to be able to tow a Sea-Doo. That's what you need to be able to tow. Not a giant box of rocks. You just need
right.
that
toys.
Yeah.
You said a toy.
1,000 pound weight in the bed. That's it. You don't need 5,000 pounds and giant bales of hay and everything else. I mean, all of those, when you go to the truck things, you guys have all been to all of the truck things that we go to, you know, I mean, it's always a giant measuring contest. When
I mean, nothing was more phallic than when Ford brought out their bolts and put them on a table, stood in front of these giant bolts, and then look at how small the bolts are from Chevy. Look at how small the bolts are from Ram. Our bolts are so much bigger. And for a small pickup, a real small pickup, not a midsize, but a small pickup that gets 40 miles per gallon and you can't drive off-road and you can't do any of that stuff, which is what most people use a small pickup for, I think that there really is a legitimate market there. And it's not from truck people downsizing. It's from car people that want something that fits in a garage, because God knows you can't put an F-150 in a garage, much less a Ram 3500 Longhorn super cab, mega cab. So I think that there is. Now, this is why I may not be a product developer either.
Well, you know, to go back to Robert Davis last week was saying about how he was driving around the Mazda compact pickup truck, and they've done the numbers and said people really aren't interested in those.
Because they always look at it from a truck perspective. I think they
that's the problem with truck development. They listen to too many people who own trucks. Is that what I'm hearing here?
Yes. Because that's not, there we go. That's not who you're going to sell this to. This truck is for the guy that is the, as far as trucks go, go around California and look at all those real small pickup trucks that how many people are using, that all the pool cleaners, all the people that don't need to carry and can admit I don't have to carry that much stuff and don't buy the what if, but the what I need. There's room for a small pickup truck.
There is.
And one thing I will say, if Hyundai does build that Santa Cruz, it will be one of the most popular vehicles with people like us who get to drive it for a week and just have fun with it. And I will enjoy it as much as anybody. I just don't see the business case.
Right. Well, you know, we've always joked that if automotive journalists ran the automotive industry, we'd all be driving station wagons with manual transmissions and diesel engines. I mean, that's that just doesn't fly with the general public.
I think if that were the case, we'd all be out of work because the industry would just be collapsed.
So I do have a last minute. I would also like to give Mark Phelan a piece of coal for objecting to the Santa Cruz.
This may take 1 year off of the...
Now there's only 260 years worth of...
Okay, I got a present I want to get to. And I don't know if this goes to a company or a person, but I like this technology called over-the-air updates, where you can... via radio waves, send new software into your car and make it a whole lot better. There is one startup I know of that's in the business called Movimento, but I don't know anybody else who's involved in the technology. But Tesla this year had a number of updates that it provided to its owners where they added blind spot detection. They actually enhanced the audio system. And they gave it this somewhat limited autonomous driving capability that even they admit is not ready for prime time. But I'm enthralled by the fact that you are, or that we are now at the point where you can buy a car, and instead of it getting more and more obsolete over the years as new technology comes in, now cars are going to be able to stay right up to snuff as long as it's software updatable. I'm not talking about updating hardware on the vehicle, but I think that's a super significant development this year that over-the-air updates have actually hit.
Tim, Chrysler probably wishes they had that for the Uconnect software flaw.
They did, but it was hacked.
Maybe this is why those Tesla batteries fail at 60,000 miles, because they're just constantly like looking for those.
Well, and there's other ways to do it, too, because, I mean, Ford has talked about with their new sync system, that when you park it at home, it can then tie to your Wi-Fi and do all the updates.
And I think that's what everybody's going to do. I mean, there's no reason that your phone shouldn't get new features and updated operating systems, you know, four or five times a year, and your car can't.
Except for if you go out to start it up and it says updating.
Yeah.
And you can't
try again later.
But that's really not a joke, though. I mean, customers will have to accept that weird stuff will happen. I mean, I got an update on my iPhone 6 last week, and the next day, and it appeared to have installed the whole new operating system perfectly, and the next day, every phone call that I got, they couldn't hear me. You know, incoming calls, nobody could hear me, and I ended up having to shut it off, let it sit for a while. So, I mean, this and so many other areas of technology that we are all going to love for a lot of reasons are injecting new areas for stuff to go wrong, and at some point we're going to have to figure out, do I accept a level of uncertainty in my car that I have learned to live with in my phone?
Scott hacked your phone. That was happened.
In fact, if you open it up, you'll find coal inside.
But it's funny. I mean, you talk to the Detroit guys about, you know, the Tesla over the year updates, and so here's Tesla improving the product that you've already bought, right? And these guys all say, you know, our customers want it fully baked. Our customers want the car done, and we can't.
That's like talking to truck guys about small trucks.
They're only saying that because they can't update them themselves.
Do you think that's what it is?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Because if they could handle recalls over the year, they would love it. And that's why they're all putting modems in their cars going forward. They're all going to be in on this. Yeah. Hey, look, we've reached the top of the hour here. We got to thank Scott Burgess from Yahoo, Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press for coming on. It's been a hoot having the both of you here.
Ho, ho, ho.
And Gary, as always, great having you here. I'll be back in a moment here with some closing thoughts. But, of course, we can't close this show out without bringing the choir back in here. And they're going to regale us with a Merry Little Christmas. Very good. Very, very, very good. What a great way to close out the show, and for us, it actually closes out the year. Of course, next week is Christmas. The rest of the crew is taking a break the week after that. We'll be back here the first Thursday in January, and we're going to have Tisha Johnson from Volvo talking about the interior design of the XC90 and a few other things that we're working on, that they're working on. So thanks, everybody, for having tuned in. Join us again then, but what a terrific way to close out the show and the year.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Fiat.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.